it's time again for another wonderful episode of the Dev Hell, Development Hell podcast. This is Chris. Over on the other channel is Ed. Say hi, Ed.
Howdy.
That was a little bit of a delay. This episode is a little bit kind of weirder than other ones that we've done because Ed and I actually recorded this when both of us happened to be at my conference 2 North PHP about a week and a half ago. We sat down while the hackathon that they were doing was winding down. And we sat down and talked, and we talked to a few different people, and we had a very special guest come on and kind of talk to us about conferences and stuff like that. So before we get to the episode, Ed, time to talk about the sponsors.
We have two sponsors. One of them is Wonders Network, which was made by a guy named Wonder, who had special superpowers. And... hey, my computer just dinged, and that reminds me that Wonder's special superpowers were finding out how long it takes to get to your webpage from Panama or Kazakhstan. That's what Wonder Networks is good for. Also, if your localization stuff works. So if you, say, serve up a different page to those in Bangladesh, as you do in South Africa, they're the guys to talk to. I don't know if they have locations in either of those places, but they probably do a better job than anybody else. So, you know, get in on that.
And also, don't forget, if you travel a lot and you're looking for a nice secure VPN solution, Wonder Networks, through their Wonder Proxy system, also will give you a cool VPN to make it look like you're from whatever country that they have servers in. So it's a pretty awesome tool as well.
Yes, they will do that. Yes, that's their other superpower, is tricking.
It's kind of like, though, you remember the old Super Friends cartoon where you had the Wonder Twins? Wonder Twin powers activate, and one was always an animal and one was always a liquid. You remember that?
Yeah, it was always like form of...
a bucket of Pabst Blue Ribbon, and then the other one was like shape of an eagle, and so, you know.
Yeah, and the eagle would do would just like drink the Pabst Blue Ribbon.
Then once it was empty, would pick up the bucket and fly drunkenly away. I remember it as a kid thinking how strange that whole episode, the whole thing was.
Wouldn't that be cannibalism?
That's interesting. So who's our other sponsor today?
Evior, I think, is how you say it.
The copy. I think Evior? You have the copy upside down. Turn it around the other way.
Rove.
That's it.
What do these guys do?
They give me money to make fun of the owner on Twitter.
That's right.
The fine folks at Rove, yep.
Right. Chris, I don't know. I've heard things that maybe it's a pyramid scheme. Have you been asked to sell products?
I have not been asked to sell products, but I'm not through my 90-day probationary period yet, so I don't know. Maybe they're gonna drop that bomb on me once I get closer to that.
See, what's great is that when you develop your personal network of sellers, they'll sell your products and make a profit. And then you'll make your profit too. It's a way to change lives. Rove. Change your life.
So on that wonderful note, enjoy the little conversation Ed and I had while we were at True North PHP.
Oh, well, I'm recording now, but I'm going to edit it later.
All right, so we'll do 3, 2, 1. Okay, so welcome to episode number 52 of the Development Hell podcast. We're recording this kind of differently with a digital recorder. We're at True North PHP 2014 in Mississauga. It's actually Mississauga. I thought it might be funny to let Ed actually pronounce it, but
Toronto. Yeah, that's how you pronounce it.
we're in like a suburb of Toronto. So Ed is up here for the conference, and as those who follow me know, we organized a conference. So right now in the background is our poorly organized hackathon, and I'm not happy with how this turned out, to be perfectly honest.
No, somebody's going to get a beating.
There'll be somebody who will be organizing things next year. We'll have to see how this goes.
Yep.
So we actually have a special guest. We have Ben. Hi, Ben. Say hi, Ben Ramsey.
Hi, Ben Ramsey.
So we'll move a little bit closer. We're good? All right. So I think we're just going to – I want to talk a bit about organizing conferences, because you've went through that, having done the PHP Community Conference, which seems will never rise again, will not rise like a phoenix from the ashes of the –
I actually have some ideas for doing another one.
Yeah.
Possibly next year. I don't know. I might be biting off more than I can chew, but we'll see.
So I wanted to talk a bit just about organizing conferences stuff, because it's kind of interesting. There's always that constant kind of thing going on Twitter where people are well, basically demanding more diversity. I want the conference to be this way. I want the conference to be that way. And I said some things about this online yesterday, kind of in a nicer way, trying to say, well, you know what? This isn't as easy as you think it is. And I mean, I had a long conversation with Ed about this when I picked him up from the airport, and we're talking about this stuff like about the anonymous selection process and all these other things. And so it's like, it's not easy. The people's perception of what it takes to organize a conference, like, oh, I'm just going to ask a bunch of my friends to come and talk. It's like, no, it's way more involved than that. I mean, you look at stuff like, even something like True North, which is a fairly small conference as far as these things go, with like between 100 and 130 attendees is kind of what we aim for. And this is going to run us $30,000 to put this on. I mean, it's, you know, that's a non-trivial amount of money, and this includes like paying for, you know, sponsorship money to help pay for the venue, and we you know, we pay for our speakers to come in, and you know,
right,
that stuff all costs money. And so we're very much, for this conference, we're very much ticket driven. So if we don't get lots of people coming out, then Pete and I are going to be on the hook to pay some things off. But once again, we managed to get our act together, and we're going to break even. So I don't know, you know, we had a long talk about this. I talked about the anonymization. People talk about, as part of the submission process, how they want to anonymize so you can't see who's submitting something. And I've always had a big problem with that, because I feel like if I'm taking somebody's money, I have a responsibility to give them as much value for their money as possible. So that means, unfortunately, I want to know who wants to come to my conference, who's going to submit, because I need to have that mix of people who are known for whatever topic the conference is promoting, so that we can get people to come. Because I honestly believe that if you, Ed and I talked about this in the car, about, well, what if you did the conference where it was totally anonymous and you didn't announce, you knew it was going to be a technical conference about a specific programming language, but you didn't bother saying, when you went to go sell tickets, it's like, we're not telling you who's speaking. Here's the topics that we're going to be covered, but you don't get any talk.
By anonymous, do you mean that, like, you're just not going to announce who the speakers are?
Yeah.
Or you're, okay, I thought you were talking about the selection process.
Earlier you were talking about the CFP, right?
Right. So, that's a separate issue, but, like, if you want to talk, because people complain that sometimes they're intimidated to submit to a conference for a variety of reasons.
Yeah.
Some women feel super intimidated. Some lesser-known speakers feel super intimidated. They feel like, I'm competing against big names or whatever. So the idea is that anonymous submissions lead to the leveling of the playing field. And I think my experience in running one of these things, that's more of an altruistic idea. It's like, you need to know, you need to know who's willing to come and speak at your conference in order to get to promote it and say, hey, these people are going to be here talking about this topic.
I don't see it as an altruistic thing. I see it as a shifting the blame thing. So people will complain when their talks aren't selected, and you can now turn around and say, well, it was all anonymous, so we didn't know, right? But I disagree with that approach for selecting speakers, because I think that you, as you said, you have a responsibility to the people who are going to be attending your conference to select really good quality talks, to select talks that you know the attendees want to see, and to, you're curating the conference you want to have. And when you do an anonymous selection, it's really difficult to do that. There's different ways you can do anonymous selection. Like the Bar Camp in Nashville, the past several years, I believe, has just completely anonymized. Like, they just do a drawing, and whatever they draw gets in.
No, oh, wow.
So it's just random.
And they don't even select based on content.
Wow.
And then there's the other one where you just anonymize the names, and so you're selecting based on content, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get a good quality speaker.
Right.
And then I think I've seen some that do Like, we anonymize it up until the last round, and then we reveal the names and then pick. I just think that these are all pseudo-solutions to what is perceived as a problem of being fair to speakers. And I really don't think that that's a problem, necessarily. Like, you're an organizer. It's up to you to pick who you want to speak. Whether you pre-select the speakers ahead of time and don't even have a CFP, or even if you have a CFP, you're still curating the conference you want to have. And I think that that's an important thing to do as an organizer.
I think that, you know, I'm not an organizer, so you got to take what I say with a little bit of grain of salt. I think it's one of those things that I think you know the pressures of it a lot better if you've actually done it. I think that... So I think that anybody who kind of sort of posits an opinion on that has to acknowledge what their experiences are, right? I think the point I remember when I was talking with you, Chris, in the car was that I think I ended up making was that what you're able to do varies a lot based on, one, sort of your goals in the end, and what you want your financial, what you're okay with in terms of financial responsibility, and really what your community is, that you think the potential audience that you have, what you think they're willing to do. I have seen conferences that have done things like not ever announce who's speaking until you just show up and you see who talks, and they've been successful. Does that mean that they'd be successful in every single situation? Absolutely not. There's, you know, so an example would be, it's pretty common with these TEDx talks that you know, those non-officially affiliated TED events, that you don't announce who's speaking, or you certainly don't announce like what the topics are, things like that. And people show up. People just show up because it's a TEDx, little X.
I find that interesting too, because there's no guarantee of the quality of it.
No, there's absolutely no guarantee.
And TEDx, TED lets them put their branding on that. I don't know how they even let.
There's been one at Purdue University for the past few years, and then there's one in that's in Lafayette, the surrounding community, and I'm actually going to be speaking at it on November 22nd, and.
So clearly the quality of that TEDx is...
Oh, it's very poor. It's very poor. In fact, maybe I wasn't supposed to say I'm going to be talking on it. But the thing is that, like, if you just put that out as there's going to be some talks, and you call it, like, the Lafayette talking event, well, nobody's going to come to it. The reason why they're coming to it is because they're all excited because it's a TED event, supposedly. Kind of not really, but it supposedly is a TED. So it seems like it's going to be a big deal, and you're trading off that name, and that's how you get people in. Okay, so that's the hook there.
I'm on the Xbox One.
Adam Culp on the Xbox One.
Yeah.
Like, you need,
because I always, all the conferences I go to, 17, 20 a year, I've never won anything, and I finally win one.
Well, now you can shut up and not complain about it anymore.
I can't, but I still have to tell you.
Look at that.
Congratulations,
like that.
On the big win.
Can I get the pusher email? All right, so...
If only I could put sarcasm tags around it.
I know.
In Tarot Bank. Yeah. So, I think that what you end up with, you know, so that's an example of a situation. Well, one, some people would probably also feel that, well, is it a fair process that they do? Well, no. They invite people to talk at these things. There was no CFP. There was none of that. They just say, hey, would you talk? And in some cases, they were like, I'd like you to talk about this thing. Right? They, you know, and so it's, is it still successful or not? Well, that's what they're trying to do. So how do we judge the success of that? You know, so then you've got some things where typically with most PHP conferences, And I think it's because that's sort of the example that we followed for a while, is that speakers get their lodging and their travel covered for the most part. Most of the conferences that, you know, most of the PHP conferences cover that. Well, that expectation puts a certain burden upon conference organizers that puts them much more financially on the hook. That a conference that is saying, we'd love to have you talk, but you know, no, we can't pay that stuff. Well, so their ticket prices can be lower, theoretically. They can't, and they probably have less of a concern about, like, well, you know what, if we don't get as many people here, maybe it's not such a horrible thing. Because I'm not so finite, I'm not like 30,000 in the hole already, right? Because I've got to get everybody here. You know what I mean? So I think that there's just you have to know what you think. Well, you have to make an educated guess about what your potential audience is going to support. You know, there's different approaches that, like, it seems like most of the Python conferences that I've been involved with, their ticket prices were lower, and they did not provide any financial compensation to speakers. Even just like, say, paying for your hotel for a night.
The reason that happens at most Python conferences is because most of them, I don't know about all of them, but most of them will, I believe, receive some funding from the Python Foundation. Yeah. Software Foundation.
Uh-huh.
And they have rules. And
right.
In order to receive money from them, you have to abide by their rules in how you run the conference and in the things you do at those conferences.
Right.
And I think that even some of those rules go down to, you can only sell t-shirts from this person who is approved to make the embroidered t-shirts for Python Software Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, that's part of it. But so some of the rules are, your tickets, I think some of it is, and I'm going to be completely wrong on probably most of this. This is just my impression from like side conversations I've had with people. I don't know the actual rules.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like some of them are about ticket prices,
right,
and keeping them low.
They want to make it accessible to people.
I think that some of them are about that they offer scholarships to people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they offer some those scholarships are also available to the speakers.
Mm-hmm.
if the speaker needs a scholarship to go speak. So that there's that going on within the Python community, and that's why they don't pay their speakers way, because it's part of the rules around what the expectations are for a Python conference.
Right.
And receiving the money from the Python Software Foundation.
Right.
And as a result, you get the a blanket umbrella of the Python Software Foundation, and I believe that you're under their financial umbrella in the sense of, like, liability.
I see.
I think. So, I could be wrong.
Yeah, well, the impression I've always gotten from them is that they're much more volunteer-driven, and they seem like they're sort of, not that most of the PHP conferences I've been at have been non-altruistic. It almost sounds like I'm saying one's good and one's, you know, out to stab you, but the Python stuff that I've seen seems like it's generally very focused on sort of being altruistic endeavor.
Also, my impression of the employers of those people who are speaking at Python conferences,
mm-hmm,
is that many of the employers, I won't say most, but many of them pay their way.
Right.
And so in a sense, those companies are supporting the Python programming language and the Python Software Foundation,
right,
by, you know, sending those speakers to speak at those conferences, and I think that's a good thing in the culture of their community.
Mm-hmm.
Something we kind of lack here in the PHP community, because I don't see that happening.
Well, there isn't a central organization in PHP that actually, like, financially tries to support.
Well, I'm talking about even the companies of.
Oh, that too. Right. The same way. I guess it's just there's a little bit of a different. That's sort of a difference culturally.
Yeah.
Right. And that's not. That doesn't mean one is better than the other necessarily.
Oh, I'm not suggesting that. I'm just saying it's an interesting thing.
Right. Right. It's just different. Right. And I guess at the end of our conversation, I remember, Chris, that we had about this, I think what I kind of felt was that I think that there's a lot of different approaches to that. And you have to decide, as a conference organizer, what you're willing to do, what your intents and purposes are, and then decide how you want to deal with, you know, certain things. And I think that you're going to end up, whenever you're trying to organize some kind of event that involves a lot of people and things like that, you have to compromise on certain things, and you have to figure out what to do. And there's nothing that says, well, this is the single way of accomplishing, this is what your goal should be, and this is the single way of accomplishing those goals. I think it is far more complex than that, and I think that I'm not comfortable going in and saying, oh, well, they can't do X or they can't do Y. I've been critical, you know, publicly of the approach that the O'Reilly Open Source Conference has, because the thing that's tough there is that they don't tell you, but you can ask, and they can try to financially support you, but generally, if you're not a tutorial speaker, they give you a ticket.
And even the tutorial speakers, if I'm not mistaken, you're not really being, it's like a ticket sharing. Like, you're getting a certain cut on the tickets sold for your tutorial. You're not getting a flat rate.
Is that right? So I don't know.
That's the case.
So the short thing is that for the vast majority of speakers, do not pay anything for room and board. You know, it's a long event, 4 or 5 days. Mm-hmm. It's on the West Coast. If you don't live on the West Coast, it'd be pretty expensive to fly out there. And then I think that you see that, and I'm like, okay, well, that's fine. But they charge like $1,800 or $2,000 for tickets. I mean, it varies. Their initial ticket price is, of course, lower, and then it goes up as they get closer to the event. But for like the full thing with tutorials and stuff, it's like over $2,000. And you're kind of like, really? You can't come up with that? That's kind of tough. That's kind of tough for me to deal with a little bit. At the same time, I've asked people who aren't necessarily the direct, you know what, I did talk some once to a guy who was direct organizer, and I guess I didn't get really a direct answer about it, but I've talked to some people who have been involved with the conference, like involved in choosing talks and stuff like that, and the feedback they kind of gave me, or at least that their impression was that organizing such a large conference in one place, the expenses were way
higher. They have a lot of speakers.
Right, they have a lot of speakers. And it's not just that they have a lot of speakers, but it's like, it doesn't scale linearly. Like, okay, well, we have 200 attendees and we have 30 speakers, this is what it costs. And then if we have 10 times those numbers, the expenses are not 10 times as much. They're, in fact, quite a bit more than that, because there's only certain places you can have an event that's that large. And then, if you have it like that, that means you're locked into a lot of stuff. Like, you have to have it at that location. You probably have to, like, you might have to use their caterers. You have to use their people who handle all their AV stuff. You have to use it.
Here's no different. We have to use their AV staff, and we have to use their in-house catering.
Right. Right. But my guess is that it might also be that it's not, like, what they're doing here might not be a sort of, you know, I mean, we've all heard stories about like running the plate, like doing it at a hotel.
Yeah.
And that it's like, here's $100 carafe of coffee.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you want it at the hotel, that's what it costs. Or you're dealing with, like, and this is not a criticism of labor unions in general, but you're dealing with, you know, unions, and they get, you know, the stereotypes, they get very expensive because they kind of like, no, you have to have your guy, like, press play on the VCR, and you can't do it yourself. You have to, you know, they have to set up. So my impression is that I'm not happy about it, but I think it's a somewhat sort of a reasonable explanation is that if they did 10 like OzCons spread around that were 1/10 the size, it would actually be quite a bit cheaper than doing it all in one place.
It could be.
But the thing you get with having it all in one place is you get this potential for crossover and permeation of stuff that you don't have, that you wouldn't have otherwise, definitely. Right? So it's one of the things I love about OzCon is I can go and I can like hear a talk about a bunch of different technologies that I wouldn't run into otherwise.
I went to OzCon 5 years in a row, and I haven't been in 5 years, mm-hmm. so it's been a while. But I would always use that as an opportunity. I mean, if I was speaking on a PHP track, I probably wouldn't go to any of the other PHP talks, because I've seen them at other PHP conferences, so I'm going to go to hear Python or Perl talks and
right.
and kind of see what they're doing in their communities and kind of compare it to what we're doing and, you know,
yeah.
see if that can make my code better.
And that's a special opportunity. It's kind of like South by Southwest, but not so douchey, right? You know? And so that's really cool, and I like that about it. But the drawback is that, hey, there's no way I could afford to go, like, if I'm not speaking for sure. And even, I know at least once or twice I got selected, and I was like, I cannot afford this, because it's a $2,000 at least proposition to go.
And all the time associated with it,
and
too.
All the time. It's a week off of work.
Day for travel there, day for travel back.
I do have a disclaimer. I'm on the speaker selection committee.
You're not allowed to be on this podcast anymore.
Damn it, Ben.
Right. So you are a mole and you need to find this stuff out. No, but also, well, when I submit, I will know who to talk to.
All right.
Anyway, but the point is, I think that's the thing that I think there's some valid things to criticize about it. But it's also really easy for me to sit back and say, well, at OzCon, they won't pay for it, and I know that they're charging this much for these tickets, so there's absolutely no reason that they should do it. Do I really know? Do I really know what's going on back there?
I have heard that they lose money on that.
Yes, I've heard that too. I've heard that they consistently lose a lot of money every year, that they treat it as a marketing loss for O'Reilly Publishing.
It's the event space that they're in is not inexpensive.
It's
pretty much have the entire Portland Convention Center.
Yep.
Well, at least half of it.
They have a big part of it.
And that's a huge convention center.
Yep.
And Portland, you think is actually a pretty decent expense-wise city. It's not really an expensive city.
It's not as bad as San Francisco, but it ain't cheap either, I'll tell you that.
It's not cheap, yeah.
It's still not, you know, I think there's sort of a thinking that it's cheap, and it might be cheap compared to, say,
and
Bay Area.
They left Portland.
Yeah, remember, they were in San Jose.
For 1 year, and went, well, before Portland years ago, 10, 11 years ago, they were in San Diego, I think. Was that right?
I think, uh-huh.
And then they moved to Portland. They loved it so much. And then 1 year they went down to San Jose, and that bombed for them.
Apparently did not do well, that's what I heard, yeah.
And I didn't go that year, but apparently, like, attendees wanted to go to Portland, and also just, like, transportation and getting around San Jose is just not the same as getting around Portland.
It's a lot harder.
The train and everything in Portland. So I think that they just didn't have as big a turnout. But it was cheaper, I believe, for them to produce it down there.
Is that right?
That's my understanding of why they did that.
That's interesting. Right. And they probably thought there might be a chance that if there's a lot of people coming from that area, maybe more would show up.
I don't know.
You know, but again, that's entirely speculation on my part.
Yeah.
I wasn't there. I wasn't in the room. And I don't know what their books look like. So I can say a lot of things about a lot of stuff. I think that you have to be really careful about making assumptions about what you know. And you have to ask yourself, do I really know what went into this or not?
I think that, and this kind of goes back to a little bit about what you said or about the blind selection and, mm-hmm. and that sort of stuff. I think people just have to be careful about assuming things aren't fair.
Yep.
Like, so pricing, that's not fair pricing. Well, maybe it's not fair because you think you can't afford it, but, like, you can't make that judgment call. And the same goes for, like, speaker selection. That wasn't fair speaker selection because I didn't get selected or because so-and-so didn't get selected. I mean, there's a lot that goes into all the decisions you make for a conference. And it might not seem fair to certain people, but it's like fairness doesn't really factor into it, I don't think.
Yeah. Now, I will acknowledge, and I want to make it clear that I think I understand at least the idea behind anonymizing talk submissions. The idea being that you have likely unconscious cultural biases that we have, and those things can show up. And so I think that's probably true.
Yeah.
I think that you have to weigh that against being blind to knowing who the speaker is. And knowing, you know, knowing that it's somebody that, oh yeah, this is one, a name, or two, somebody I know is a good speaker. I saw them speak someplace else, or I saw a podcast they did, or I know they blog and they're a really good writer or something like that. Well, you lose all that stuff if you toss it out. And that's a tough thing because both of those things are valuable. You want to eliminate as much as possible these, I think most people want to eliminate these biases that would lead them to show preference when they don't intend to show preference. At the same time, that's a hard thing to lose, like just having no idea who it is, because I don't know, I've always felt like every time I've submitted a talk, I've been like, I wrote it up and I'm like, I don't know, why would I pick this? Like, it's just, like, I would pick it just based on, like three or four sentences? Like, and there's lots of CFPs I've responded to where that's really all they ask for. And I've seen some that ask for a little bit more.
What I think is interesting is that, can I name the conference?
I'm going to get a drink of water while you guys talk.
All right. And this is not, I'm not criticizing this conference at all, but Confu has a limit on their character count for your submission, which I actually kind of liked because it allowed me the chance to pare down my my proposal to just like what was absolutely necessary to get the point across.
Right.
But it also has the downside of, like, as a selector, like someone reviewing those submissions,
right?
Like, there's not a lot of color in there. There's not a lot of detail. I don't know exactly. Like, if someone is bad at writing a proposal, then like they might not be able to whittle it down to a small proposal.
Yeah, I guess I just feel like if you want, it's tough because I guess at the end of the day, it's what are you trying to do? Are you trying to give everybody an absolutely equal opportunity to speak?
Yeah.
And that's your priority. And I don't think that's invalid, and I don't think that that's a horrible idea in and of itself. Then if that's what you want to do, that's awesome. And I think there's room for stuff like that, just the same way that I think there's room for things where at the whole opposite end of the spectrum, where there's room and value in conferences where they say, show up and you're going to see who we're going to have, and we're going to have awesome speakers. And you just know that. Or you just say, hey, here's the 20 speakers we've got. And that's who it is, and that's what you need to know. And there's no open process. And they're both valuable, right? They're both. You can have great conferences either way. So I think anybody who tells you there's only one way of doing it is full of it. I don't think it's true. I don't think it's accurate. I don't think it plays out that way. It's just different. So I guess what I'd say is, if there's an area where you think that's not being filled, I think the best thing you can do is do a conference yourself that fits the model that you want it to fit. And if it's successful, then that will inspire other people to do it, and that's great. But it's really hard if you say, I haven't been involved in the process at any point, but I'm just sort of complaining about it. I have a lot of trouble with that because that is super easy to do. And I just know that I've done the same thing, and I think I've just been way off base on it. I just don't think you know what it's like, and I think it, you're not in a position to really to raise what I would say are accurate, you know, actionable criticism, right? It doesn't mean it's not, it's, you know, it's just different, man. It's just different. So it's kind of like, we're so empowered to do so many things that, like, I think there's a lot more room to do, be doing something than just kind of complaining to one group. It's not like there's sort of like a Illuminati who possesses the ability to put on conferences.
Man, if only it was really that way. I would be speaking a lot more.
Yeah, right.
Flying business class, too.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's just not like that. And it's like in the...
You're assuming that you're in the... You're among the Illuminati.
Of course I would be.
Yes, of course, absolutely, of course.
Of course I would.
But, I mean, when I... In the
Lake Wobegon. Lake Wobegon Community Conference Selection Committee.
You're right. You know, in the 1990s, I did video game fanzines. It's because I wanted to do it, and I wanted to talk about stuff the way I wanted to talk about it. So I did it, and I started off, and I had a typewriter, and I photocopied it and sent it out to people.
And totally see you doing that, too.
Yes, yeah. I did it.
Yeah.
And I did it because that was what... And I was 14. I barely knew what I was doing when it was first time. But you don't do something like that because you're going to get rich and famous. You do it because you enjoy doing it, and it fits some kind of goal that you have at the end of the day.
Like Pete and I decided to do True North because there was no Canadian PHP conference. The only, right. one you could go to was you could go to Confu.
Right.
I think they just said it. And they had PHP track, but it was... They were focusing on all sorts of open source stuff.
Sure.
It was no PHP-centric conference. Even in Toronto, there were very, very rarely any kind of open source technology-based conference would blow through town. It just didn't happen. And I always wondered, what was up with the Toronto market that there seemed to be no support for it?
Yeah.
It was weird.
That's actually why I wanted to do the PHP Community Conference. And it probably would have happened earlier. But I'm just lazy, right?
Yes, I used to work for you, Ben. I know.
What happened was the first Brooklyn Beta, several people, Nick Sloan and Lisa Denlinger, were talking to Chris Shiflett and just said, hey, we kind of want to do a similar conference like this. And he said, oh, you need to talk to Ben. Because he had known that I had been interested in doing a conference. And, I mean, the reason for that was because I saw, like, an opening there. Like, at that time, this was in late 2010,
yes.
early 2011, there was ZenCon and PHP Tech, and that was basically it. There was also, what else was in North America that, before we did ours? I'm trying to think. I can't think of anything else right now.
It's just basically ZenCon and Tech. There might have been some one-off conference summits, but in terms of other PHP conferences, I don't think there was. It was Tech and it was ZenCon, and that was it.
And they had a couple other ones that MTA did that were sort of like here and there.
And they did the PHP Works one where they did the tour.
PHP Works was in Atlanta. Right. But they also did that one that was that traveling.
Yeah, yeah.
I believe Works was originally in Toronto, though.
Yes, so that was the very first one I ever went to. Was PHP Works first conference I ever went to?
So I just saw an opening there, like a need.
Mm-hmm. So I think we're gonna get kicked out of here. In a little bit. I think
well, you can finish
o'clock.
It up.
I was just we my thought was just like I saw that need, and then that same year, like all these other community conferences just exploded.
Yes.
Yours was that year too. I was
2011. Yeah. No, 2012. We did the first.
12 was the first year.
Yeah.
Lone Star was in 2011.
Correct.
Right after we did ours.
Mm-hmm. Copycats.
There was some controversy, not for them,
yeah, right.
But because they were 30 days after Tech, and we were like within 30 days before Tech. So like there was a little bit of...
people could suck it.
There was a little bit of bad blood there, which was unfortunate because it wasn't intentional.
No, right? I understand.
Yeah. It just happened that way. And, everyone has hugged and made up now, but... But yeah, that happened. And then, so Lone Star was that year. Northeast PHP was that year, too. In Boston.
Oh, in Boston, yes.
Oh, yeah. And they're still doing that, right? I've never been out there, so...
I believe they started in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And then Sunshine PHP and True North PHP and...
Yeah, I think it's great now. We've got a lot of stuff.
So now, yeah, we have all
Madison
sorts of... there's all sorts of, like, smaller community... What community, and we can talk about it real quick. For me, the idea of a community conference is the idea that you want to keep it small. You're trying to focus on
developers, mm-hmm. or not developers is the wrong word, attendees mm-hmm. in a limited geographic area with the idea of you want to bring in, mm-hmm. you and you're also willing to bring in speakers from outside the geographic area mm-hmm. because they're going to be able to deliver high-quality talks. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of, that to me seems to be the model now for these. You get these smaller, they're capping them at like about 200 attendees, yeah, most right. of these kind of community ones, so it's the same thing.
Generally, they're run by user groups.
They're run by user groups? Yeah. And more and more often, they're run by people who speak at other conferences. That's the very interesting thing about mm-hmm. it, too. Like, run this one, Adam Culp, the Sunshine, the Midwest PHP folks are all people mm-hmm. who have spoken at other conferences as well. I don't know about the Northeast one.
It's run by Boston. Well, it's actually
run by the Boston. The Boston one's quite large.
It's not just Boston, though. It's the greater, it's that whole Northeastern area. Yeah. So Vermont.
New England?
Yes.
There you go. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a Vermont PHP user group, right? Mm-hmm. Or I don't know if they're called Vermont PHP, but they're in Burlington.
Yep.
Burlington Code Factory?
The same.
Mm-hmm. Is that?
That's where
it's
from.
Okay.
Or someone will correct us.
My geography is starting to fail me right now.
But it isn't.
So there are several groups in that area that have banded together along with Boston mm-hmm. PHP. And Boston's group is huge. I've heard of like attendance at some of the meetings ranging in 300 and more.
That's a great number. So, wow. That's impressive.
Yeah. So that's kind of seems that's the model now. The idea, I guess, you know, keep the conferences smaller and once.
But even in your case, like, even though it's not specifically run by the user group, you've got a user group anchoring
yes.
in this area.
Kind of what we do is like, so we run this thing, we collect all the money, and then our goal is to break even. And anything that's left over, rather than being given to me to blow on magic cards, we instead take it and we give the money to the Toronto Users Group. So then we've done stuff like we've brought in that. Well, unfortunately, I don't go out there much anymore because it's between my family and when my wife gets home from work and me trying to get from where I am out in Milton into downtown Toronto is a pain in the ass.
Hey, we've all got problems. We don't need to hear
about it. Yeah, no, I got 99 problems and the conference ain't one. And so I can't come out anymore. But we pour the money back into the PHP user group. We helped bring Brendan Savage in when he was doing his little crafting code tour, and mm-hmm. we brought other people in. Just, it's kind of a good way just to keep the vortex of less suckitude going.
Yeah,
just
right.
Conference group, user group, conference, user group, conference, user group. Keep that spinning and getting more and more people to come.
Right. So. And that helps grow a community that can support a conference like this. So it absolutely pays off.
We have people flown in from Edmonton, from like Alberta and Western provinces. We had some people drive up from the Buffalo, New York area. So we're starting to slowly expand. But you know, the idea is like there was nothing here for people to do. So let's give them a conference. And I had enough connections in the community to convince people to submit. And then I recognized people. And that's the same thing. Talking about for me, it was a combination of. We want to get the submissions, so of course we create a tool that now other people are using, which is awesome as well.
Right.
And then it's like, okay, so I'm looking to see who submitted, and I recognize the names, and sometimes there's new people. So, I mean, we have a bunch of new people. We actually do a lot of more, I think more than 50% of our talks this year are by people who did not speak here last year.
Yeah.
So we changed it up, bring new people in. I took a chance on a bunch of speakers.
Right. Then come in. Mostly that's embarrassed you.
No, it's been good. No, quality of talks is usually really good. Of course, you're going to get the odd clunker for a variety of reasons. I've delivered terrible talks. It's been a long time since I did. I did a really terrible talk, but it happens.
Yep.
But the important thing is to give people a chance. And
I have done some terrible talks.
Yeah.
In my day.
What do you remember? Like, what was your worst?
Well, the one that stands out is like the first one I gave, right?
Well, because
it sticks out really, really vividly in my mind. But there's another one that I did.
Yeah, that's your third cup of water. You need to be cut off.
There's another one I did. I don't remember all the specifics of it. I just know the feelings and the impressions, right?
Right, yeah.
Like Jacques and I tried to give a composer talk at Nashville PHP Together once.
Uh-huh,
and it was kind of thrown together last minute, right?
Yeah.
Because we didn't...
Your first... Yeah,
I can't remember if there was like a speaker who backed out or we didn't have someone that
right,
night.
Right, yeah.
And so Raphael had his slides online and we were like, hey, do you mind if we use your slides?
Just do his talk. Okay.
So we like pulled
Jesus,
them down.
Really? That so was, you and Jacques tag teamed your way through somebody else's
just
talk?
Like last year.
Were all the notes in Portuguese?
It was horrible. Oh, there's Raphael right there.
Hey.
There we go. We're just talking about them.
I was saying that
we're doing
Dev Hell. We're almost at the end. So.
Oh, cool.
I was saying that Jacques and I tried to give your composer talk at Nashville PHP once, and it bombed.
I remember that.
It was horrible.
It was not the slides.
It was the delivery.
Yeah,
it was
right?
the delivery.
It was the man makes the talk.
And then the very first one I ever gave, and I find this story kind of humorous, is the talk was called Framing the Frameworks.
Okay.
This was in April or May of 2005.
That's a clever little alliteration.
Yeah, yeah.
Like that.
Yeah. Like little play on words.
Little hooks them. Yeah,
yeah. Anyway, so at the International PHP Conference, took a chance on me. I'd never spoken before.
Was that where you took that had that picture in your talk from?
No.
You looked like you were like 13 in that.
I don't know.
It was a picture you were on the tram or something like that?
Yes, that is where that came from,
right,
yes.
Okay.
So I was not 13. I was 25 or
that's
so.
Still pretty young, dude. Yeah.
Anyway, so I gave my presentation, and I had been up almost all night the night before working on the presentation.
And by working, you mean?
No, I wasn't drinking. I was actually, well, I did go down and drink some. Well, but no, it wasn't that.
Oh, too bad we don't have a video component to the podcast. It would have been good.
So I had, I've been working all night on slides. And went down I went down to the Riot Conference Center, gave the presentation, totally nervous, like completely, and the room was jam-packed full. It was probably one of the fullest talks I've ever given.
Full of angry
Dutchmen. Full of like project managers
looking
for me to tell them what framework to use.
Yeah, I'm sure that's exactly it.
Seriously. Anyway, afterwards, we go down and there's like refreshments and that sort of thing, and I'm talking to this guy. And I said, I made the first mistake, and that was asking him, well, how did you think it went?
Oh, no, he never asked anyone how you think.
That's when I learned.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, right.
And he said, well, I think we both know how it went. And then I made the second mistake, which was, no, how did it go?
Oh God.
And then he says, it was horrible.
Oh, my God.
And that's was this a Dutch guy?
Oh, it was a German guy.
Because if it was a Dutch guy, it would be straight in your face. Yeah, it sucked.
That's when I learned.
More than a German.
More, because the Dutch are extremely honest and objective. To them, there's no rudeness. It's just being honest.
Well, that's when I learned, unless I want a brutally honest answer, never ask a German for their opinion.
A German or a Dutchman, apparently.
A
Dutchman or a Deutschman.
Yeah, oh, wow, that's right. There you go. I see what you did there.
Not just a pretty face, Ed.
Yeah, right.
A Niederlander or a Deutschman.
Yeah, right. So, I'm trying to think. I definitely had talks that I was like, boy, that didn't go well. And I actually got... I remember I've had some where I was like, I was not feeling it. Like, I felt like I really stumbled my way through it. And I can't remember exactly what the topic was. But I remember it was very, like, I felt really like this didn't go well. And I got really good feedback, so I was like, eh?
Well, it's like for me,
I've had that happen.
It's like for me earlier this year when I did the testing tutorial at Tech.
Yeah.
And I just realized that, oh my God, I'm trying to get these people to learn too much in too short a period of time. So I spent like the first 5 minutes of my talk the next day saying, okay, who here was in my tutorial? So that's why I kind of like apologized and said, look, I know we went through this thing yesterday, but I feel terrible because I did such a shitty job.
Yeah, right.
So I'm like, okay, next time I do one of these things, it's going to be better. So I apologize for trying to cram like 8 hours of material into your head in 3 hours. And then I launched into my talk. But that's basically kind of like my mistake now with talks is ones where I'm cramming too much information.
I think the talks where I feel like I'm doing bad in are the ones where like there is definitely an energy you get from the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And like if it's right after lunch or like first thing in the morning, mm-hmm. you might not feel that energy, but they might still feel like it was a good talk.
Yeah.
That they got something out of it. But, you know, as the presenter, you like for me at least, I feed off of kind of that audience energy and you can feel it by, I mean, you look at them and people who look really attentive and really interested, that's when you kind of start feeling that kind of, and you get like endorphins going and all that from that.
It's also cultural. Yep. Depending where you're giving a talk, the audience is completely different.
You're right.
I mean, I've had talks in the Netherlands where you see nothing on the faces during the talk and you're like, oh man, I tanked it. It was awful. Mm-hmm. And after the talk, they come up to you and it's like,
that was amazing. I'm like, could you show that to me during the talk?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's true. I definitely have things like that. Have you had the experience where you get up there, and partly, you know, I really don't. I very much tend to wing it when I get up there. I think I know what I'm going to kind of talk about, so I just get up there and kind of do it. And that's, there's pluses and minuses to that. But I'd be interested to have you all had that experience where you get up there and you realize that you just don't know what you thought you did about something, like something just pops into your head where it's suddenly there's just like a block, like you don't have the words. Either one, I've several times forgotten what I was talking about and just have to be like,
I haven't had that problem. Just my problems are sometimes either I don't have enough material to fill the time slot,
or
I have
like
too much and I suddenly realize, oh man, I'm going to have to cut a whole bunch of stuff out and then trying on the fly to like think about what can I not talk about and still tie everything together.
There's like, oh shit, there's no way I'm going to get through this in 45.
I had a loss of words, but that's basically because I lost my voice before the talk.
See, you have a better excuse for it. You had a physical...
Well,
look at this guy.
We were waiting there.
Well, we're just finishing up DevHell. We had like 2 minutes.
I think to your point, Ed, like, about like losing words, I routinely have that problem.
Yeah, right.
When in the middle of a conversation, it's amazing me that I'm even being able to carry on a fluid conversation right here. And maybe because there's a microphone in front of me, but most of the time I will stumble and stutter and just forget common words, and I'll be up in front of the audience and that'll happen.
I think that's a thing. I'm not going to diagnose you, but I know that for me it has to do with my ADHD, and it's just the way that my brain works, that sometimes it's like it seemingly can't recover something that it knows.
And it's frustrating to me because it feels like it's happening more and more as I'm getting older.
Yeah, but your brain's losing it.
That's probably happening. That's what it is.
Yeah. I find that rehearsing helps me with that. You get to know, like,
I don't rehearse sometimes.
Trying.
If you rehearse enough, you kind of like, when you get stuck, you remember what you said during rehearsal.
I've started taking more presenter notes and writing things down in there.
Yeah.
I feel like there's an important concept that just popped in my head, I'll jot it down in there because I'm like, I know I'm going to forget that.
Yep. I think using presenter notes has helped me a lot too, which in some ways that makes it a little less spontaneous. I really should practice more. I should rehearse more. That would probably give me better talk. Because I know I've given that open sourcing mental illness talk. Well, tomorrow will be the 14th or 15th time that I've given it. And I am much better at it than I was. And I've learned tons about it, and I've changed. It's a different talk than when I started, but I'm also better at it. I can do it just... But at the end of the day, it really would have been better if I just practiced it. But
okay.
I don't know. I'm just not. I have trouble doing that thing where I'm just like, if I'm just by myself in the hotel room and giving the talk, I think I'm somehow too self-conscious to do it right there.
Blush elephants, man.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, yep. Those elephants and put them all in front of you, and there's your audience.
It's like the duck that you talk out the programming problem.
Yeah. Rubber ducking.
Rubber ducking. Elephant plushing. Well, I think, you know, maybe this is a... You know, we didn't talk about... We'll probably have a sponsor here. What do you think?
I don't know. Figure something. We can do it in post.
Yeah, you didn't want me to... I'll just put, like, a robot voice in it. Right. Like,
this episode...
I can totally do that, too.
You should totally do that.
All right. Okay, we'll do that. But I think we probably have to wrap up, so...
Yeah, because I think the security here is going to start wandering around and want us to
start tasing us.
So this has been episode number 52 of the Development Hell Podcast, so...
Five deuce.
The five deuce?
The five deuce.
That's terrible.
Cinco deuce.
Cinco deuce. So, dropping this 50-second... Never mind.
Yeah, right.
So, thanks to Ben for coming in and talking about some conference stuff.
No,
Ben, Raphael came by, and other people...
Michelangelo.
And Adam came by. And Adam came by to brag about him finally winning something.
Oh, yeah. I don't think Adam even knew we were recording.
No, we'll tell him.
Nope. That's fine.
So this is episode number 52, recorded via the magic of digital recorders at TrueNorthPHP. We'll see you all in episode 53. Goodbye, Internet.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
So that was a very different and unusual way of doing the podcast. I want to thank our special guest who came on. We had Ben Ramsey, my old boss at Moon Toast, and I'm going to virtually pour one out because Moon Toast is no more. And Adam Culp for coming on and bragging about winning an Xbox. But yeah, that has been episode number 52 of the Development Hell podcast. As always, I want to thank our sponsors. Ed, you want to thank the sponsors this time?
I was told specifically to thank Rove, that they make many fine products and are an excellent way to get your life turned around through multi-level marketing. And
hold up. I think you're confusing Rove with Amway.
No, it's my understanding that Rove, they recently, and they signed a couple years ago a 3-year deal to be the presenting sponsor of the Detroit Red Wings.
No, I don't think that's true.
Let's see, and
go ahead.
Well, they're since 2012 they've been the lead sponsor of the Canadian Championship.
Canadian Championship of what?
Soccer.
I think there's either a man in the middle attack going on your computer, or you're like reading some weird alternate Wikipedia site. Yeah, sorry, Rove is none of those things. Rove.
Oh, my bad. Yes, it says Amway, not Rove.
Oh, see, I knew it. Sorry, Evan. Your money's still good though.
No, but he sells Amway too.
Oh, he does? That actually makes a lot of sense. Do you know he wants to buy a boat? That's like his lifetime goal, to buy a boat.
I guess he can
just stand on the boat and just yell, "I'm on a boat," and he can play the T-Pain and Lonely Island song over and over again.
Wasn't that the goal of the dad in Step Brothers?
I haven't seen Step Brothers, so I couldn't tell you.
You should definitely watch that.
I don't know. Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly, I don't know. I don't think they're such a good combo. Of course, I'm lying because I love Talladega Nights, but that's a different story. All right,
they're a great combo.
All right, so thank you, Evan, and the other folks at Rove for supporting the podcast.
Wonders.
Yeah, and then let's talk about our next sponsor.
Oh yeah, I'm interrupting you. It's very unprofessional. I don't think we have our stuff together. The Wonder Network, which is all about computers and the wonderful world of computers. How do computers talk to each other? Does your computer sound the same way in California that it does in Brazil? Wonder Networks knows. Thank you.
See, I'm normally muted for this, but I couldn't get to the button in time. Paul and Will at the Wonder Networks, you're doing an awesome job. Thanks always for the support.
Will Ferrell, yes, at Wonder Network. So
that's another podcast done. So thanks to the sponsors. As always, you can find everything to do with the podcast at devhell.info. I remember all those years back when Ed and I first talked about this. It all started off, he had an awesome domain name for us to use. So every single episode of the show is available at devhell.info, along with awesome graphics where Ed seems to have a sixth sense for figuring out an appropriate funny image and titles. You can also find show notes, although I don't think we have any show notes this time, but we need to listen to get the info.
We didn't write anything down.
We're too busy keeping an eye out for the security guard who was about to kick us out because the hackathon was going too long.
Yep.
So you can also listen to the podcast via iTunes. If you do listen to it via iTunes, please, please, please rate the podcast. It lets us know if we are doing the awesome job that we think we are. If you want to talk to us on Twitter, you can send messages to us at dev_hell. Of course, Ed and I are on Twitter all day blathering around, so you can find me on Twitter as Grumpy Programmer without the U. You can find Ed on Twitter as Funkatron with the U. As always, thanks so much for your support. Thank you for listening. And Ed and I will talk to you all soon.
Good night, Internet.